Okay, great. So we're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Miles Sims. I work for Small World Labs, and we provide online community solutions. It's a hosted solution, a white label solution for organizations, entrepreneurs, businesses, nonprofits. My role is I head up our community solutions team, and we essentially help our clients from start to finish build thriving communities. We provide community management services as a part of that. So leading the panel today, we've got some great panelists. We're going to go down the line. We'll start with Oscar and just kind of let them spend a couple minutes introducing themselves, talk about some of the unique aspects of their community, both size-wise, answering some of the questions about what they're doing for monetization and monitoring those communities.
Hi, everybody. I'm Oscar Martinez. I'm the managing editor of Neighbors Go, and it's the weekly community newspaper that the Dallas Morning News produces. And I've got an iPhone, so I'm going to put the stopwatch on right now so I don't talk too much. One of the things that we, to give you a little bit of background, we have 17 print sections that come out every week, every Saturday, and it launched as Neighbors, as a basic community newspaper, user-generated in 2005. And up until last year, actually at this time last year, our online presence for Neighbors, at the time it was called Neighbors, was PDFs, you know, clickable, you know, page by page, and they have their value, don't get me wrong. April of last year, we launched neighborsgo.com. And what it is one of the main reasons we launched it was we were doing things via email. You know, like I've told everybody on the panel here, they all send me attachments of their kid's soccer game or things like that, community building, civic projects and what have you. That's fine. Send me attachments with a Word file, a photo or two, that's great. Translate that to everybody in this room, my email will shut down. And that's what was happening. So it made a lot of sense at a lot of levels, and we just kicked in. You know, it really complemented. We had the luxury of having had this print product with a combined circulation, again, 17 sections of about 220,000. And one of the great things we do to monetize it is that it allows people, advertisers, a way to get into the Dallas Morning News. You know, and we're on top of the Dallas Morning News every Saturday. And so one of our challenges on the website was creating a daily presence for a weekly product. And I think we've done that. And by, like, so many themes that are running throughout this conference, opening it up. You know, this sounds like old hat. Oh, yeah, social networking. This tool, that tool, upload photos, upload videos. Believe me, for a major market newspaper to say, and it's from an editing culture to say, let's just open it up. Oh man, people were terrified. It's like, that's the biggest challenge in the world. It's like trusting your audience. And you know, that wasn't mentioned in one of these things. I know that's a big theme of these communities, the moderation. How do we do it? And we're working through that. But I know there's been a really good response. You know, we've had, you know, again, that email, that value proposition, and validating, instant validation online, and then validation of the print product of coming out in the newspaper as well. And in addition, the other luxury we have, I'm at 220 right now, the other luxury we have is that we have a TV station, WFA-TV, that we get mentioned there. So people talk a lot about leveraging the media. We're actually doing it.
My name is Jake McKee. I run a social strategy and consulting firm called Anti View, and run a blog, communityguy.com. And in a former life, I was a community manager for Lego, the toy company, primarily responsible for our adult fan relations, which was an interesting dynamic in a company that was 95% kid-focused and 5% adult-focused. I have to say, I don't speak for them, but I speak to the experience that I had with them, and since I'm no longer employed by them.
Hi, my name is Daniel Benner. I come from a background in film, and one of the things that I did in between film gigs is to learn more about web technologies, and got more and more interested in that, and then started looking for ways to combine the two. One of the things that I noticed while I was producing films and working as a cinematographer for some film projects is that we always ran into a couple of problems that were very similar. One was is that we were always tapping people from within a limited network to do the various jobs within a production, so it wasn't always the right person or the person that had the most enthusiasm or the best availability for that project. And that always made the quality of the overall product suffer a little bit. So that was something that you know, I thought could be fixed and should be fixed to increase the quality of what independents can really do. That was really the thing that led me to think about, you know, how do I raise the visibility and accessibility of all the many talents and resources that are out there in the indie world, but are not being utilized to their fullest extent, that could, in fact, if they did, help raise the quality of what's being done in that community. So I put together Jindy to help, as a first step, solve some of those issues, help expand the networks of people so that they're aware of other resources that are out in the community. Finding the right people for the right positions at the right time, I think, is a key element in helping these projects be more successful and keep their momentum. One of the things that it came up initially in the questions was, you know, how did we get launched? And the way that we did that was to develop relationships with people that were already connectors and, in some cases, you know, folks that just had a lot of information or about a particular topic. One of those folks for us was a gentleman named Dan Eggleston that runs the Austin Film Casting List. By introducing him to what we were trying to do, we were able to get onto his mailing list. And that's a way that we were able to seed the community with the initial population. And from there, we started to actually attend network mixing events where people got together locally and, you know, promote the idea of membership in the community, what's happening. And that really helped us to get started. The thing that is helping to keep people to come back is because of that effort initially to get some nice people on the site, we were fortunate enough to have some people in the community that were respected. They approached us and said, hey, we'd like to write a, you know, question and answer column for you on some topics that I think your audience would be very interested in. So that was something that really led to a huge surge in membership for us, is introducing content that was really relevant to our target audience. So we have a lot of actors, and we were fortunate enough to have a casting director named Donnie Hardy that helped us to bring more people in by letting the community ask her questions and get responses based on their expertise.
Hi, my name is Pat Dugan, and I'm with BeliefNet. BeliefNet is an inspirational type website. Most people think it's religion, but it's way more than just that. We have roughly about 3 million unique visitors to our site every month. And we're broken down into different areas. We have a newsletter, which some of the newsletters do deal with the particular religions. They also deal with health and inspirational things, jokes, what have you. We have about 12 million subscribers to those newsletters. Our major focus is our forums, where members can go and visit various sites that deal with religion, anything from your major religions you could think of into, I think last month we started at one for the Jedi Knights. Yeah. So we have pretty much anything that you could think of is covered there, as well as community things that people might be interested in, whether it's depression, weight loss, news and politics, what have you. That by far is our largest section. We've also got blogs, where we have bloggers who, some of them are very well-known people, such as the editor for the Dallas Morning News, Rod Dreher. He does CrunchyCon, which is by far our most popular political blog. We also have people like Deepak Chopra, Shmuley Boteak, Therese Bouchard, Neil David Walsh, Feeler, who wrote Walking with the Bible. We just have all kinds of different bloggers. We also have some of the staff members themselves who write some of our blogs. I work as a community manager, so I oversee certain areas. Our forums are mostly monitored by volunteers who have been trained. Then someone like myself would step in if there's a problem, if I get emails from members complaining about other members or complaining about the monitors themselves, then I would step in that case. I also oversee the blogs themselves and pretty much most of the political and religious communities, which can be quite interesting to get into debates. We have a wide range of people that love to visit our blogs, and we get participation from everyone from very liberal atheists to very conservative Christians who love to argue with each other on the blogs very, very much.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jennifer Bouchard, and I work for Save the Children. And my role at Save the Children is to run our community that is for internal usage only. Although the agency does have an external community plan, I stick with Save the Children employees. And we are in over 120 countries in the world and face a wide variety of technology and cultural challenges and opportunities as well. Some of our offices got electricity about 6 months ago for the first time, and others are on high-speed connections all the time. And so I am creating a community network for collaborative small groups to work together, and also communities of practice. And so my focus is probably a little bit different than everybody on here in terms of I'm completely internal, but it's no less challenging and interesting, and we have to face a lot of the same types of issues about bringing people into the network, gaining their trust, having them come back on a regular basis. And we have a number of lessons learned since we went into beta last June. We thought we would do well by establishing a group and saying, okay, you're going to be our beta group. But they said, we didn't want to be your beta group. And we learned a whole lot about just kind of throwing people in there and revamping how we're going about developing our communities and creating jobs for people that will be moderating communities. It's a great job. I'm loving it, and I think I'll let us move on to the next questions. But I look forward to sharing more about what we're doing at Save the Children.
Great. So as we get into the questions, one of the things I'm going to do is instead of holding Q&A at the end, I'll just be kind of surveying. If you've got a question, bring it up when it's relevant instead of trying to remember it and have it at the end. Have more of a conversation. I think there's more value there. So kind of the first thing, everybody's done a great job kind of describing what they do and a little background on their company or organization. I want to get into just a little bit more on the actual community management side of that. How many people are on the community management team, some roles and responsibilities, how they're impacting things, if they have documentation, you know, what they're doing overall. I know some of the folks on the panel are by themselves and the sole champion within their organization, and other people have a large team of people. So I think having a little bit of conversation, a little more background specifically on community management is kind of the first topic.
Well, it's funny because when I have 15 section editors, four assistants, and one synergy editor makes it all work together. And talk about a luxury, that's 20 editors to me. And then Miles opened my eyes to, oh, they're community managers. That's what they're doing. And so in addition to putting out the print product, they're actively looking at the online component, where I didn't mention this earlier, but the 17 sections cover about 40 communities in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Online, we've got about 65, so about 25 more communities. And you know, one of the biggest challenges is you know, we're trying to accurately reflect in a timely way each of those communities, and it's certainly easier said than done. But we have a lot of the foundation was built again. The original Neighbors product, we have the luxury of having this print tactile thing. And again, that foundation, each of our editors had between 500 to 1,000. One of our editors had 3,000 contacts in his email. So it's not an email blast, it's not spam. It's this guy going to the HOAs and going to all the PTA meetings, showing up at these meetings where, you know, it's nothing on the morning news report, but it's a big major market. They've got, but they're so, it's focused on breaking news. It's focused on, you know, clusters within, you know, designated territory, city hall, you know, the police beat, things like that. And, you know, even when we had, a year ago, at probably a year and a half ago, we had 100 more journalists in the Dallas Morning News building than we do today. And even then, it was a misnomer. We could not cover that area. So by opening it up to people and letting the community themselves, you know, submit their information, and we just help them publish it. You know, we like to look at the site as a starting point for their news. I mentioned earlier, Neighbors Go Print, Dallas Morning News Print, WFA TV. But in addition, there's 7 more TV stations. You know, they're looking at our site every day. Why? Because they need a daily something, a daily, you know, what's the spark? Where's the energy? Where's the enthusiasm? And people are finding it on the site. So, you know, as far as it's a work in progress, certainly, and it's a process. We've been doing it for about a year. We're just starting. I mean, it's exciting to be here, to hear some of these ideas, because, you know, as far as the major market newspapers are starting to get into this, oh, we need to be in that space, which, you know, they probably should have been 5 years ago. We probably should have been as well. But it is part of an overall strategy to not depend so much on the old media, just the print product of the Dallas Morning News. It's part of an overall thing to have niche publications, focused, targeted advertising and content as well.
So I have the opportunity to work with a number of different clients, everybody from very small startups to very large companies that have 30, 40, 50 people doing community work. Maybe they may or may not have community managers specifically, and that's part of why I'm there in the first place. But I sort of span from one person who does community management part-time as part of the rest of their other 4 jobs, in a startup environment, all the way up to very large organizations that are trying to learn what to do with all these things they've been doing that, to Oscar's point, they didn't really realize were community management or community activities.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about is some of the mistakes that I made when I was starting this. And one of the things that I think initially that I thought that later I found out is absolutely not necessarily the case is I thought that because these folks that were in the film community, which would be populating this user-generated content, would be enough to really draw repeat visits and get people excited about connecting with these folks. And I found that that just wasn't the case. I would look at the Google Analytics and, you know, although we were driving the memberships, the average return rate was not what I wanted to see it at. So to fix that, the thing that I started to do was to, when I got those people that were willing to do question and answer columns, that was an easy way for me to bring some new content in that didn't take a lot of time to work, but really addressed some of the community concerns, and that really helped improve that. So that was one of the initial lessons, is that content is still king. Okay. Yeah, that's
a good question.
Okay. So the question is how did I get people to actually ask the questions to these experts and drive that to make it happen? The way that I did the first column introductions is I leveraged some outside lists that weren't, you know, people that were members of other lists. I would put out a press release that some new content was going to come up and that they were accepting questions. Eventually, when I got a couple of these question and answer things going, I would just ping the community on a bi-monthly basis to let them know that there were some new content updates, just to get them trained that we're always going to have new content on the 1st and 15th. Actually, they saw that this was a forum for them to... typically, the people that were experts were folks that were older and more experienced, and they were looking for a way to give back to the community that they had, you know, either made a lot of money doing what they were doing, or were just, you know, slowing down, but had a lot of things to share. So they actually approached Jindy and said, "Hey, we'd like to do this." And once one did, some more naturally follow.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm curious,
Yeah, it's a good question. So the question is, in a you know, working with a brand like Lego that has a very physical product, especially when I was there, which was 2000 to 2006, and it was a whole different environment. When I started, the idea of building our own community was just kind of crazy, just because of the fact that that wasn't as easy to do as it is today. But in that environment, you know, how do we get the online-offline connection? And how much time was spent sort of offline activities to help drive our relationship versus online? I don't know what the percentages were, but it was a good mix. And the idea that I very quickly realized, even in 2000, was that the line between online and offline was blurry, right? So the idea that there was a big distinction between what happens online, what happens offline, started to disappear in 2000. By now, there's very little distinction because we're here, but we may be using online tools to showcase which sessions we're in, but we're actually sitting in a physical room and talking to physical people. But tomorrow we'll go home and check their blogs, and then that'll lead to maybe beers because we realize they live in the same town and whatever, and it gets very mixed up. And so, you know, I did spend a lot of time as somebody who was employed by the company, just going out to the events that were happening. I mean, I sort of joke that I spent more time with five people in a basement than I spent in a boardroom, right? And it worked really well because what happens, of course, this is the online-offline distinction. I'd show up in somebody's basement, hang out with them for a couple of hours. They'd go, wow, he got on a plane to come see us, hang out with us, answer our questions, and we're only five people. That's amazing. That is so cool. I'm starting to think about the company that's ignored me for 70 years much differently. And so they would then immediately, as soon as I left, what would they do? They'd get on their computer, post to the forums, and say, guess what happened to us? We're cooler than you guys down the street in St. Paul because, well, he hadn't been to St. Paul yet, has he? And then that started a lot of discussion. And so people would sort of, you know, get to know us through those little small visits, even if I was never able to make it to all those little small places, if that makes sense. Yeah, so the question is, since I was responsible for the adult fans, what was the connection to the kids, the kid fans, the kid users? And that was the whole point, right? It's a great question because that's the whole premise of why I was convincing colleagues that, yes, they may be 5% of our buying audience, but they're not 5% of our influence audience. You know, a group of, again, the five guys from the basement can show up at a shopping mall on a holiday weekend and see 20,000 people come through that are, you know, kids and families and grandparents and whoever set up a 25-foot square Lego train layout that is just one of the most amazing things you'll ever see in your life and have a much different engagement than we as the company ever could, because now there's kids coming up and saying, well, this is cool. How long have you worked for Lego? I don't. Wow, that's really cool. You mean I could go home and do this right now? That's cool. Mom, can I go buy a set? You know, so it that was really what we drove towards, is not sort of trying to separate or combine them, but to figure out what makes sense for the influence on one that actually is something interesting. So if we could help arrange that shopping mall visit, for instance, it was good for us. But it was also really cool for them because they couldn't maybe have set up that type of display on their own, or they may not have thought about it the first time, or they may have thought, oh, that's, you know, we could never set up anything that big. And I sort of challenge them a little bit. Oh, if you can do that, I know if you can do 10 square feet, you can do 25 square feet. That's no big deal. And sure enough, they do it. And so it sort of all flowed together. Again, the mix of things was sort of flowing from one to the other, back to the other. Yeah, so the question is, what happens with adults and kids interacting online specifically? And that gets, you're right, there are a lot of privacy issues, but more importantly, there's a lot of interest issues. There's a lot of interest for somebody to do something offline that, you know, the fans showing up to do a display in a shopping mall is interesting to them just because they finally get together with four other people or 10 other people or however many and put together something that's as big as their house. So they obviously couldn't fit the whole thing. They couldn't afford the whole thing on their own. But when they come together and see it offline, wow, this is pretty amazing. But online, kids don't necessarily want to interact with with adults, and adults don't necessarily want to interact with kids. It's a different. There are times when that happens, certainly, but you know, when I'm an adult hobbyist, I want to hang out with other adult hobbyists. I want to talk about things that are similar and interesting to me. And it's a hobby extension. It's not necessarily just a brand extension, if that makes sense. So that we didn't run into a lot of issues with that. There were, of course, issues where you'd get a 10-year-old who really wanted to come hang out with the adults because the adults were doing such cool stuff. And it was really because we didn't do a lot of the community stuff on our side for the adults. They were doing plenty of it on their own. They had a photo sharing site before Flickr existed. They had forums like MAD. They had all kinds of stuff that was supporting them. They really made those decisions on their own. But for the most part, it was very, very self-selecting. I mean, 95% or more of the time, that wasn't an issue because the kids didn't want to hang out with the adults and the adults didn't want to hang out with the kids.
Jen, do you want to talk a little bit about your community management team? And
yes, I am the community management team. I have been slogging away at it for about a year, as I said earlier, by myself, and we have a potential audience of 10,000 employees around the world. So it's been an interesting road, and we have had to come to terms with the fact that we also have to do marketing internally. We have to recruit others to become community moderators themselves, and how to make them successful and autonomous, because I can't be the one who's the technical community and everything support for these communities. So it's one of these things where we're just starting to kick off a full marketing campaign internally to find out who the stakeholders are, who are the experts in their various areas. Similar to the GIND model, we have people who are experts in child protection, emergency response, nutrition, education, and they have so much knowledge to share, and identifying who those people are is a tough thing among 10,000. And we also have partner organizations, and getting them involved, you got to find the right people who have the time and the energy as well. In their minds, they're out there saving children. And how do you talk to them about the fact that joining a community and sharing with your colleagues on the other side of the world will actually help you save children more efficiently and more effectively? Because you have something to share, and your colleague on the other side of the world actually has done a program just like you're trying to do. So rather than rebuilding the wheel, go ahead and talk to them, find out how they did it in the first place, and re-implement that same program with maybe some cultural changes, or you know, something that is unique to your area, but you don't have to do it again. And it's been a lot of lessons learned, as I also said earlier, with we launched a beta community that didn't really want to be a beta community. And we've had to back off from that. And as soon as we did, and we started reaching out and saying, this is a really great thing, kind of changing our tactic, since January of this year, we've officially gone out of beta, and we have people knocking down the doors. And thankfully, we just hired somebody who's going to be helping out, and we have a format for how you can become a moderator, how you develop your community, and the responsibilities of, you know, what does it take to have a great community. And so we're on our way. It's very exciting. Okay. Yes, and I do. My job is actually technology and training. So I do a lot of training, and the technology gap is very wide. Some people, you know, even in countries that you would expect that, oh, they don't have really good connections, but they have internet cafes. And a lot of the younger crowd especially will make an effort to go to internet cafes so that they can interact online. So they know how to use it, they just may not have the connection at work, per se. And so we do a lot of training for how to use the tool one-on-one, and I use live meeting to do that where I can. Otherwise, it might be on the phone only, and they're sitting on their end driving. And our site, we have customized it to be pretty light. We have very few graphics, and we try to use them effectively so that we're not weighing the site down. And I can use our site on AOL dial-up. Well, there's a couple of things, and I'm not sure if it's going to get exactly to what you're speaking about, but we do have not anonymity, but privacy issues, because we some of our members, we're actually Save the Children is an alliance. Save the Children U.S. is incorporated in the United States as a nonprofit, and we are by far the largest of the Save the Children's, and there are Save the Children's in Sweden, Norway, Germany, etc. And we all kind of come together under the alliance, and we're trying to work together more and more. And as you can imagine, the EU privacy laws are far more stringent than ours. And so I actually get a lot of pushback from our European friends on, you know, making sure that we're keeping privacy really strict. But everybody needs to have a profile, so you can't be anonymous on our site, per se. But there's also the struggle for sharing best practices of we're coming to learn about our identity as the Save the Children Alliance rather than just Save the Children USA or Save the Children Germany or what have you. And it's a cultural shift and many levels, not just technology for us. And so we're working actively on those. And, you know, my inbox is the place where they complain. We have been throwing that about. So I think we're going to.
So that's a great segue kind of into the next question about getting support, not only from a community standpoint, but like Jen mentioned, the beta testers that didn't want to be part of the beta group. From an internal perspective, whether it's, you know, a nonprofit organization or a business, One of the big things in community management is how do you get and maintain support for the community inside the organization itself? So one part is the user of the community, be it employees or customers, but you know there's other people inside the community that there's a fear factor. Oscar mentioned that as well. You're different dynamic. How do you keep that, and how do you get it, and how do you keep it going?
Well, let me jump in too to sort of build off that, but just to answer this earlier question too. I think what happens is that we get into a discussion of can employees voice concerns in an anonymous or a non-anonymous way. And I think that the real question that the anonymous question asks is whether or not the culture supports honesty. And I always tell clients that I'd much rather have your CEO's time spent in the blog comments, not in creating his own blog, right? Because that really helps to share, that the culture is okay, that he's on there agreeing or disagreeing or talking or interacting. That's going to send a message to the whole rest of the organization that this kind of discussion is cool. So in a situation where you have one or two or three employees who are comfortable with that type of complaining or, you know, concern voicing or whatever, and you see the CEO actually come in and respond to that and say, "No, it's totally fine. This is great discussion." Then it sends a very powerful message very, very quickly that this is okay. You're not going to get fired for this. And you know, the more that the CEO understands that, that's one of the best top-down mechanisms I've found. I think I think people put way too much emphasis on the top-down part of it. But I think that's one of those areas where if you can get them on board to just spend 10 minutes a week just answering a comment here and there, that's a much better use of their time than trying to get them to do a couple of hours a week on their own content or to do something separate, because then it just seems like you get another place where the PR group is speaking for the CEO, and that's probably not really him or her. That's just, you know, that's just corporate communications throwing something together that they're putting their signature on, sort of thing. But I think the culture is, you know, changing that culture to actually make this stuff worthwhile, to make the voicing of, you know, we don't want to be beta testers, and that's okay to talk about. I think that's really important, that gets skipped way too much.
One of the challenges that we have in our community is that we're trying to drive offline projects through an online community. So this is a situation where we really know that if you're going to work with somebody that you find in a social network, that you really have to trust that person, and you have to figure out how are you going to trust that person from the profile. So one of the things that we've started to do as an experiment to see if we can build that trust better is to utilize what we call vouching. And this is, if you've worked with a person before and you feel like you have something positive to say about that person, they showed up on time, they were dedicated, they were skilled at what they were doing, tell the community about that, because that makes a difference. If I visit somebody's profile and five people have vouched, and I can trace back from those comments who those people were and possibly email them as a third-party witness, that's going to help make that person's profile more worthy for me to reach out to and say, hey, this person might be the right person with the right skills for me to utilize. Yeah. I would say that, you know, we don't do like, you know, a secure check in terms of like they have to perform a credit card transaction or anything like that to really identify whether they're that person. But it's more based on if you're there in that community and you're vouching for somebody. If there's no photo on that profile that the vouch is coming from, that loses its credibility instantly, I would say. If there's no information on that profile, another credibility strike. So those are the kind of things that me as a person, if I saw that, I would choose to remove those from my profile. So I'm going to keep the ones that are people that I think are also respected and also are independently vouched as well. And, you know, it has to be, you know, based on your perception of trust of the people that are vouching. And, you know, if you look at them, what is the perception of trust that other people have in them as well?
So tying that back to the, you know, the internal piece, a lot of what we're talking about is, you know, decisions that are made before the committee launches about how we're going to identify, you know, valid members of the community. Kind of having those conversations internally. I know, Oscar, you've got some good insight there as far as, I mean, like you said, it's a different world.
Sure. One of the advantages we had was, again, the contributors we had since 2005. We not only know their names when they uploaded their photos, we recognize them instantly. And sort of what Jake was saying earlier about the validation, it's so funny because, you know, these kids, and literally, you know, teens and tweens and what have you, MySpace, Facebook, whatever, all the newest, much more, you know, advanced stuff, you should see them squeal in delight when their photo's in the paper. You know, it's like they still love that, you know, and that validation, again, the instant online and then in print. And I think, you know, one of the things we did when we launched about lessons learned was we would go to these events and we would meet the community and try to sign them up on the spot. You know, it was not a good idea because it's like when, you know, I'm dealing with one person trying to sign up, even if there are 10 of us there, there was a lot of people there, 20, 50, you'd see people leaving each one, you want to, you know, get back. And it's time better spent talking, again, having this conversation, having that communication. That issue of trust is crucial, obviously. You know, it's something that, you know, they've trusted us with their news. They're sharing their news. I keep saying, we're asking people for a lot. You know, we're not paying them, and we're asking them for their information to share their lives with us. Yes. No, the question is whether we distinguish between our reporters and the community itself. The answer is no. I mean, you hear a lot about citizen journalists. We're trying to turn that around, and it's journalist citizens. Now, I live in Frisco, Texas, which is 30 miles north of Dallas. And the old joke used to be, news is what happens to editors. You know, you come in and there's a traffic jam. Hey, let's write a story about the traffic, you know. And we kind of turned that around. Don't leave your experience at the door, you know. You know, it's a ridiculous thing. I was driving down the road the other day, and I saw this this huge tractor trailer rig. And on the side of it, it had this huge tarp over it. On the side of it, printed, was Starship Equipment. I was like, what the hell is that? You know, Starship Equipment. So, you know, really dangerous, take a photo of it and upload it immediately. And, you know, it generated some comments, but the whole point of it was, wow, just think, and people, and I was going to say, what if people did that every day? And they are. They're doing it all over, you know, between Twitter and all these Flickr and all this stuff that's going on. Our job is to filter that, you know, and how do we get an experience out of that that is constructive for our readership, you know? And right now we're just experimenting and seeing what happens. But again, that's just a quick example of, hey, I saw that. I thought it was very weird. You know, I want to share that experience with other people. And I think that's, you know, thank goodness that most people have that need. We didn't create the need to share, you know, media, to share the stuff. We're providing the tools to allow people to do that. Right. Sure. Well, one example that comes top of mind is the it's kind of a funny one where in Mesquite, Texas, another suburb of ours, there's a group called Keep Mesquite Beautiful. They have a mascot of a little ladybug. The ladybug's head went missing. Somebody took it. And so the PIO, again, this is another factor to bring into it. He is enlightened and knows the tools, and it was essentially with a press release, news release. But he wrote it like a story. You know, the smart people do that. He posted it. Within 5 minutes, we had it on the landing page of neighborsgo.com. 5 more minutes after that, it was on the homepage of dallasnews.com. We're talking a million page views, 100,000 uniques every day. And then I circled back. I went back and met with the gentleman in Mesquite, and he said within 30 minutes, every TV station was calling. And I'm not saying that we alone did that, because obviously the news release went out to 1,000 people, but I think that's a point where not just newspapers are changing, but the actual, I always think about that, the PIOs, the PR, the marketing folks, and, you know, the smart ones are getting it and are in that space right now. But everybody, I mean, to think that anybody in this room is going to send me an email and I'm going to get that in print, I don't know you, you know, it's like, where's that trust, where's that connection? And I think it goes back to basic reporting, you know, for a lot of people, the Dallas Morning News, it's our staff. Because they go to these events, they go to the elementary school to cover this and that and what have you. And again, nothing on the DMN. I mean, it's just there's so much pressure. And what somebody mentioned in the back to start off about I like to call social networking fatigue. I mean, it's just, there's so much stuff out there. Internally, we have something called initiative fatigue. I mean, there's so many things, you know, that's just, where do you start? And that's a battle, you know, it really is. And the only thing we can do is, you know, keep showing our value. And I think in doing that, again, that word comes to mind, that luxury we have of being able to leverage that media. Because again, that daily something. You know, I've worked with one of the TV reporters in one of the bureaus, and he turns to me the other day and he says, got any story ideas? And I said, I'm about 10. And sure enough, he did one of them. I'm like, wow, is it that easy? You know, and then that access, that connection, the more we publicize it and the more we help people, especially for our demographic, you know, in terms of whether it's a PDF or a Word document, whatever it is, or a video, this is how you upload a photo. This is how you know, I mean, a lot of things that we think we're so many steps ahead. I don't pretend to know everything about it, but I know we need to break it down in ways that people can understand it.
So I think, you know, we've kind of started to touch on that, but really building trust, both internally and especially with the users or the constituents of the community. Somebody brought up reputation earlier. That's a big piece. There's questions about Can I charge for access to the community? Even the Oscars group Neighbors Go, they publish stories that are presented on their website. Should they have to pay someone for that content? Those questions are all out there about building trust with who's on your site, how they're using it, and then trying to manage that across both, employees, people internal to the community, and new people joining the community.
In the case of BeliefNet, we're a little bit looser on registration. The people that join the forums and stuff do register with a username and an email address. That doesn't mean that some people don't necessarily abuse this by coming up with several different email addresses and usernames and be the same person. On the blogs themselves, we don't even require registration at all. But what happens with our community is that we have our participants who are so close-knit in each of these different little forums and blogs that they participate in that they can spot someone who is pulling their leg in a second. And I get emails constantly whenever somebody is, not quite being truthful as to who they are, or if they're using somebody else's username. That sometimes happens occasionally, especially on the blogs. I got an email back this weekend I need to deal with where someone is using someone else's username. But as I said, they're just so tight-knit in their little communities that they like to participate in, they self-monitor themselves. It's not a big problem. They just let us know when there's a problem. Yes. Well, basically what happens is on our website we have a link if anyone is interested in becoming a moderator or monitor for our group. And we have a written downloaded material for them to go through once we have decided to allow them to do so. What happens is if someone applies and says that I'm interested in taking care of this particular forum, all the assistant community managers and manager, we have one community manager and three assistants. I'm one of the assistants who just happens to be here in Austin. We all discuss this person to see if there's ever been any problems with this member. Normally there hasn't. I mean, I think most people know if you've caused a lot of problems not to bother. If there hasn't, then they go through the material that is downloaded for them. They answer some questions for us to make sure that that they understood what we want them to do. And we do watch what they're doing. And the members on the different forums and blogs and so forth, they understand the rules of conduct, and they know when a monitor is overstepping their bounds. And they will complain, believe me. They will complain if the monitor is not doing what they think they should be, or they think that the monitor is picking on them. So again, that's part of our job as a community management team, to go in and check. And perhaps we train the person, and on a very, very rare occasion, ask them to remove themselves as a monitor if they cannot be even with all the members on their group.
If I could jump in here too, as I said in my when I started, it was the mindset of trusting people. It's just, it's very difficult, because the first thing everybody said in the newsroom was, "You're not going to monitor this before it goes online. Oh, there's going to be porn. There's going to be racist stuff. There's going to be this and that." Today, how much of that we've had? Zero. And, there's been articles about that, the New York Times, whatever. You know why? Because there's 50 million other sites that they can do that on, and all it takes is one griefer to cause that problem. And we're going to have that, I'm sure, at some point.
Yeah, that's true. We don't moderate before, no comment is looked at before it hits the live line. Some of our members think so, because with the blogs, sometimes our spam filter will grab something. Usually it has an embedded URL, and it thinks it's spam, so it will grab it, and it will give them a message that says it's being held for moderation. And no matter how many times I go online and post something saying, really, it's not. That's just the message that you're getting. Some of the members think we're moderating. We do not moderate ahead of time. Once it hits the line, it hits it. You've posted it. That's it.
Sure, and every piece of content on our site that has a report is objectionable thing, which is pretty standard.
And it's not that I can't go back and remove it or even edit it if necessary. It depends on the community. Some of our communities are very conservative, and so vulgar language and so forth is just not acceptable in that area. Something like a political group, though, where they're discussing what's going on with the Democratic primaries or whatever, we tend to be a little bit looser, unless you're getting just totally nasty and attacking other members just horribly. We try to step away.
Yeah, one of my favorite anecdotes about the reporter's objectionable feature, somebody had made a, you know, humor is very subjective, right? Somebody had made a joke about something, and we couldn't figure out. It was innocuous. It wasn't necessarily funny, but whatever. But we asked the person, we contacted, why are you reporting this as objectionable? And they said exactly that, because I don't think it's funny. Okay. And then it was classic, because our response was, okay, we'll see what we can do. Which, you know, I don't know, what do you do with that?
Well, I think somebody had asked earlier, too, about the community killers. And I think it's very simple. I think it distills into one, at least as a primary, fear. The fear of all these negative things. And I've been in some rooms with some planning sessions where I've heard the nicest, sweetest people come up with the scariest stuff you've ever heard of in your life. And you just don't understand how that scenario could come out of that person's brain. But it did, and they want to plan for it, and they want to be prepared for it. And it's part of the reason, too, why I think that, you know, how do you do it? Well, part of that planning process has to be about owning it, not letting the lawyers own it. Because if you fundamentally think about what the legal team's responsibility is, what they went to school for, what they're being paid for, what you want them to be there for, it's to reduce risk to zero. Community is not about reducing risk to zero. You'll never, ever reduce it to zero. The business person's responsibility is to reduce risk as low as possible while increasing the return as high as possible, right? So they're fundamentally at odds. And what happens is too often we're scared of the legal team. And we're scared because they have a degree and they have the ultimate trump card, which is, well, we can't lose that. We can't win that in court. And so we just say, okay, fine. We don't make them explain. We don't make them do anything. And so what we give up our ability to fight against that fear because we turn it over. So I think the best thing that I talk about a lot with my clients is let's come up with a solution first that works for us. Bring it to legal and say, okay, help us point out the problems. And then when they do, don't just take that at face value. Have them explain them to you. You're a smart person. Have them walk you through what the issue is. Some of those you're going to say, all right, fair enough. That's a requirement legally. Well, you know, that's a problem PR-wise, whatever it is. But that's understandable. I'll give you those, but I'm not going to give you these because that's just silly. And you're trying to reduce risk to zero. We know that can't happen. So, all right, next. What's next? I came to you for advice, not for you to help me plan. And that's something that I think all too often gets left behind in that community building process.
Yeah, it's a very fine line to walk because, I mean, you get, on one side, you get some people who are afraid to participate because they think things are just a little too hairy with the members are very confrontational. On the other hand, though, you really don't want to step in and be moderating it too toughly, you know, or going in and removing too many things and editing stuff. I mean, because that really will kill the discussion. Plus, they complain a lot online if you do that. So it's a fine line.
One of the things that talking about this and kind of, I know we're getting close a little bit on time, but I wanted it to come up because it was brought up as a question is, you know, expectations. Jake mentioned reducing risk to zero is never going to happen. You know, what are the expectations from the legal team versus the community manager? But also from a technology standpoint, I mean, I think that's something that comes up all the time. Why doesn't this do that? How are users using technology, and how does that change over time through the community? So really, how from a community management standpoint, teams are looking at those things and identifying, just like the joke that wasn't funny, identifying a feature or a concept that is or isn't broken.
It's pretty amazing because, they 10 years ago, like I go to these groups and they always say the same thing. How do we protect kids? How do we do this? How do we do that? I can't protect your kids. You know, I can't protect them online and I can't protect them in the real world. But they're safeguards that you have in place. And, you know, the same people who are complaining about, I can't figure out that upload thing, that site doesn't work, they didn't know how to use email 10 years ago. And it's like, wow, you know, you got these things called digital cameras, you got these USB ports, what are those? You know, what you connect them and you're going to email them, what's email, you know? And it's amazing the expectations as the technology gets better. Everybody thinks the solution is a button click away or a push, you know, whatever, and it's not. It's much more.
Go ahead. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I can answer that question from the perspective of Jindy. You know, one of the things that we wanted to do initially was attract some really quality people. But then we got to the point where there was a lot of voyeurs, too, that just wanted to get on the site to see what was going on. One of the things that we've leveraged very successfully is the notion of folksonomy to protect voyeurs from people that have quality profiles. Because when you do the search, you're only going to get people that have been tagging themselves with the attributes that you're actually looking for. So the folks that just post a picture with nothing really of value in the profile are never going to come up in the searches, except if you do something by a basics demographic type search. So that's helped us. One of the things that, you know, just to change gears a little bit, my panelists here, that Oscar and Patricia, they run very large communities. I run a more a smaller size community that has what I call a vocation focus. You know, it's just around the stages of film, from writing a script through actually post-production on it. So we're never going to get probably as many people as Oscar or Patricia and Gleefnet here. But what we try to do is still figure out ways, how are we going to monetize a smaller size community in a way that really works for us? And a couple of things that made me believe this is possible is that I have a good friend named Lindsay Blanton that runs a site called Radio Reference. And this actually has become the world source for hobbyists that do scanner radio type things. And they have all the scanner frequencies on there. They talk, you know, there's hundreds of posts to their blogs. But their community size is really only about 150,000 total. And this is built up over about 6 years. But they already have monetized this in a way that, you know, they're getting plenty enough money to support the basic website and you know, some profitability out of it. But the way that they've done that is that all the content is free, but the uniqueness about this, and this is the model that I'm trying to emulate, is that they've done some value-added services around that content. For example, all the radio frequencies that these people are coming there to look for is the content of value. What they've done to monetize it is created an API that allows a web service to access those frequencies. So they've given that API to companies that develop the software for these scanner products, and they've incorporated it into their software that they deliver with the product. So when it comes home to the person that's actually going to buy it, they'll buy a subscription to Radio Reference to get those frequencies to import them directly into their scanner. So that's one way to really effectively monetize content, is providing a really value-added service layer on top of the free ways to access.
And I was going to say very quickly, too, I think part of the answer to that question is making sure that the community understands what you need to see happen as well in order to stay healthy and happy and get them really connected to that mission. The same way that you always hear word of mouth marketing people say that the best way to get word of mouth is to ask somebody to tell somebody else, right? It's the same thing with community. You need to make sure that they understand where your vision is and then ask them to help you with the mission. If they understand the mission is that you need to grow bigger because of some serious issues, some real issues, and here's what they are, here's why they're important, then they sort of understand it personally. They take it personally and they say, okay, cool, we're here to help out. How can we help? And that's when you come in and say, okay, great, now you understand and you're excited. Here's what we need to see happen. We need to grow our numbers by 10%, by 100%, whatever, in order to keep this happy and healthy because of these reasons. Most likely they'll jump on board, but otherwise it just feels like, well, this is our niche. Step away from us.
I'm sorry. Just real quick, we actually require each of our communities to do a vision and a mission statement now so that they know where they're going, how they're going to get there. And in the case of the question, I would say we would probably ask them to come back together and revisit and rewrite their vision and their mission statement. Just like any business would have one, a community really needs this direction as well.
Real quick, just on what, when Jen mentions communities for Save the Children, one of the things they're doing, a lot of us think of those as groups within a community. And so to on that, I think one of the things she brought up earlier on the cultural side is something maybe we did touch on. But all the countries and cultures that are a part of that, So not only the groups themselves, but you know, just different cultural expectations across trying to do something like that online.
Mm-hmm. BeliefNet had launched a very large update on our site this past year. And that was a little bit problematic for some of our members, that the way the forums look is totally different. Plus, we launched a brand new community where members can have their own journals, upload pictures, videos, music, whatever. And for some people, that our site happens to have a lot of people that are a little bit on the older side. It was a problem with technology and carrying over. What we did was that we launched several forums before the change and afterwards, where our moderators plus other members made themselves available for questions, so that they actually helped some of our members who wanted to continue as members but wanted to learn the new technology changes that were occurring, and they took them on a step-by-step basis and held their hands until they were savvy. And we really did not lose very many members at all from the changeover, and it was pretty drastic change in the look and everything. So the community comes together when they have to, if you make that available for them to do so. Yes. It's almost impossible for them to do so, because for one thing, we do list the names, the usernames of those moderators for the websites. Or the different form, rather. And if someone is pretending, though, like, for instance, on the blogs where there's no registration necessary, I go through, for instance, and read almost all of the comments that are made every day, and that's about 600 to 700 per day. And I can tell, you know, from the response that someone's made, if they've given themselves a username that is the same as either the blogger or the name of the blog, and I'll just go in and erase it and either make it anonymous, or if they've signed off as some person, I'll go ahead and use that particular name.
So I think...
Very quickly, do your moderators have any sort of icon or anything next to their names that sort of specifically call them out differently?
I think that with our new launch and stuff, there was something that underneath their name, when they post something, it says that they're a moderator. Some of our moderators really don't participate much online at all, while others do a great deal. But believe me, the members, like I said, there's such a tight-knit group in each little forum. They know who the moderators are, and they can tell if someone's acting different than they should be.
So yes. We've got it, just real quick, we've got a few minutes left. I put up our slide on resources. I know from a community management standpoint, just places to go. As a company, when we started to put our community management plan together, Jake's blog was actually really inspirational. So that's always my first stop. If you're looking, even recently, he's talked about what a community manager is, the skills should have, all those things. So, you know, these will be on the Small World blog, and these resources online, as well as posted on the South By blog that's part of the interactive. So I think we may have time for a few questions until they shut us down.
Ms. Shettleman's been I've not come across that yet. I can't think of anything that's ever happened to any of our communities. But that's a very good question. I'll have to ask. None of the communities that I particularly oversee has that happened on. I'll have to ask some of the other assistant community managers if that's ever happened to them. Like I said, I mostly deal with the blogs and politics rather than that little smaller. Communities.
Go ahead.
I bug them. but seriously, for us, the profile is truly the most important thing, because we have them list what their area of expertise is within the agency. And so if they don't put that in, then essentially it's almost useless. And so I will look through those who have recently registered and kind of check in. I mean, over time, that is probably not a manageable model, and I'll have to recruit others to do that. But we bug them to fill it all in. And, you know, our care is a little different. We, you know, we're a company, so I can kind of say, you know, this is an internal tool. You need to fill it out. So others might have, you know, a completely different answer.
Yeah, one thing that we do is, you know, the point is to connect with people to help you leverage your talents and resources in the real world. So if you're not filling out your profile, you're not going to be making that connection. So, you know, it's purely about, you know, getting employment, job opportunities.
I always joke about peer pressure by graphic design too. I think there's, you know, a lot of sites where you go and you see the blank empty icon. It looks kind of ugly. Yeah. And the profiles that have the icon or the names or whatever that aren't filled out yet, they sort of draw attention to the fact that you look kind of foolish because you haven't gone in yet and updated that, because the guy right behind you that has the really cool icon and the really, you know, interesting profile design or whatever, you know, the listing design, it looks much better. And so by default, he makes you look even that much worse. So, you know, there's a bit of a peer pressure element that you design into the site as part of the original strategy to help drive up that participation, just because you don't want to look foolish, right?
I've also heard the pressure of, like, tagging in terms of being able to tag a person as a no photo or something like that. That can drive some peer pressure towards posting things like that.
Right. I think we are officially out of time. Everybody's going to be up here for questions. And I just wanted to thank everybody for coming to the panel.